Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Today, my guest for this episode is Paul Nguyen. He's a producer who's actually been on the podcast before, and the executive producer, Jeremy Grimaldi, of a movie called What Jenny Did. This is a powerful documentary about a Vietnamese-Canadian teenager who killed both her parents, a tragedy driven by this intense cultural pressure and these impossible expectations that I talk about quite often on the podcast. Their story isn't just about what happened, it's about why it happened and how pressure, expectations, and family dynamics can spiral out of control. And this episode challenges us to reflect on how we treat ourselves, our parents, and our children, and what it truly means to show compassion and understanding. So stay with us as we explore this intriguing story, What Jenny Did. Jeremy Grimaldi here, along with Paul Nguyen, both guests that worked on What Jennifer Did. Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast.
Hey, Kenneth. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming back on, Paul. How did you two meet?
You know, it's one of these, I guess it's a modern day story. I think I Googled Vietnamese journalist Toronto. And there was two guys that came out. Paul was one of them. And I contacted him, or our team contacted him. And next thing I knew, he was stuck right in, finding pictures of Jennifer Pan and giving us all this good stuff. It was great. Didn't know how small the community was. Or I shouldn't say small, it's tight the community was.
And Paul, how did you have this sort of like connection to the family?
I don't know if you remember the character Nam in the doc. She's the one that went to high school with Jennifer, right? And actually, I mean, I was always involved in the community, Vietnamese community, for many years. And then for some reason, I knew Nam like around that time it happened, I think 2010. And then Nam just told me like, oh, you know that girl in the news? I know her, right? And I just brushed it off because, you know, I was not paying attention to it. It wasn't like a big thing back at the time yet. It didn't explode. And then so funny. Later on, when I'm working on the documentary, I remember that little snippet of a conversation from 15 years ago that this guy said, I went to school with her, I knew her. And I was like, oh shit, I got to track this guy down. Fortunately, I worked with his dad. We sit on the Vietnamese Association board. We did a lot of things like planning Hoi Chu Tet, all those kind of things in Lunar New Year. So I stayed close with Nam's dad. Anyway, so yeah, I reached out to Nam and he became a big part of the documentary.
Most random setup. I mean,
absolutely.
Remy reaches out to you cold, and you just happen to remember a conversation from 15 years ago, and then now you guys are putting things together.
That's when I always find that things work out the best, when fate kind of bites you in the butt. That's when you know things are going to click.
You know, I think that when somebody like you set out, Jeremy, as somebody who wants to explore this story, there's so many ways that you can kind of approach it. What was your internal guiding system to say, I'm going to go and focus on this aspect of the story? I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I want to kind of understand your guidance system on the inside and how to tell a story like this.
That was easy for me. I'm a journalist. I was trained in the UK. British journalists have a tendency to go after sexy stories, a lot of drama, a lot of hard news. So that is one part of it. You could tell right away that this is a crazy story that needed to be disseminated to the public. The second part of it, I would say, is my dedication to being unbiased and trying to take the story, from where it is rather than where I want it to go. Not creating a narrative, focusing in on Jennifer not as the bad guy, but just trying to tell her story and tell the story, without letting the public decide who's the bad guy, who's the good guy. In today's world, everyone is so focused on labeling people this, that, or the other. And I've always tried to approach it from, let's go on a fact-finding mission. And by the end of it, maybe we'll come to a conclusion that's sharp enough for you to be able to decide with all the information who is at fault. In most cases, I've always believed that there's two sides to the story. So finding out who's at fault is probably easy for people. But in this story, and with many other stories like it, you can always say, but, yes, Jennifer could be called evil, but she was raised in a household. She was raised by two parents. So it's a very complex story, and I just tried to do it justice.
Now, I kind of approached this opening with both of you reverse. So I kind of like wanted to sort of hear that early, how you put it together. Can I get a real brief, just for the audience to understand what Jennifer did, what the story is about? And then I want to just go back and focus on what you just said about the parents, because that's like, for me, one of the biggest crux of my questions is the parents, and not to say fault, but I do want to hear about it. So a little bit about the story, and then we can dive back into the questions about the parents.
Small town. It's not a small town anymore. It was a small town that grew called Markham. It's above a place called Scarborough, which is where many immigrants come to Canada. Many immigrants will come to Scarborough, establish themselves, and then move to wealthier suburbs. Markham is the, Chinese or Asian suburb. So a lot of Chinese, Vietnamese, Asians will move from Scarborough, where they landed, to Markham. It's a very peaceful place. It's very quiet. It's sort of like a bedroom community in many ways. And there's not a lot of murder, or at least there didn't used to be. And when this crime happened, it was on upper middle class street, suburban street. It appeared to be random. Police painted it as random when they told the media about what had happened. So it caused panic. It appeared that people were driving up and down the street, chose a house based on its look and feel, and decided to rob the house. And in the process of robbing the house, they murdered the mother and put the father in a coma and tied up the daughter. So it caused a bit of mass hysteria. Now, 2 weeks pass, and we find out the daughter has been arrested. But during those 2 weeks, it looked like a random act where people were shot for essentially for goods, for money or equipment or cars or just some sort of wealth. So, having people murdered for items in a home invasion, that's random. Is very scary for Canadians. It's not normal. Yeah. So that's where it started. Where it ended is she was arrested, and it unfolded from there over months and months and months, where a lot of other people were arrested as part of a plot. And then you started to understand. But to begin with, that's why it captured so many people's attention, was because the idea that it was random.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
You know, nobody deserves to die in the fashion that her parents died. Nobody deserves that. And I try to really do some soul searching on how I'm going to ask the question of this sort of culpability of the parents and the way they raise a daughter like that. And again, I'm really sure, so nobody deserves to die in any way, it, like a homicide or murder. And I'm asking, you know, a very because I live it. I live around it. And Paul, I think you understand, you know, that kind of question, that line of question where you see when parents put so much pressure on a young child to perform the way they envisioned. They didn't live their life a certain way because of the war or because of trauma. And they put all this pressure for their daughter, their son, to become something that is completely artificial to humanity. Did you ever feel that that was sort of at play here? Or was Jennifer just an evil child?
Yeah, so from the reactions, once the story came out, the documentary came out, and I heard a lot of comments, especially I was interested in listening to what other Vietnamese people thought of the situation. And I noticed generally with the parents, they're like, they drove her to the lessons, her father drove her. And then, so the older generation I would talk to, they're like, wow, she's lucky. She owes everything to her parents. They provided, they paid for the lessons, they paid for this, they paid for that. Like, she owes her. She shouldn't have done this or she's in the wrong. The younger people, because you know, they're growing up with being second generation and growing up westernized and not being part of the whole, you know, history of the boat people. They have a slightly different perspective where, like, they more empathize with Jennifer. And it's like, I can understand parental pressures. It almost made me crack being aware of mental health and how that affects people these days. So I think there's a more awareness with the younger people. But the older people are like straight up like, I took care of you. I fed you. I put a roof over your head. Like, you have to obey. And I see both sides. I understand both sides, as I'm sure you do too.
So it's kind of going back to what I said earlier. I'm not Asian. My father was a second generation, so I'm a third generation immigrant. Now, he was pretty strict, but I wasn't a model student by any stretch. And he never put pressure on me to do anything in terms of a career. So I'll just outline that. But I'm a pretty strict parent. I believe that children should be raised with guidelines. So I just wanted to preface that. So in terms of what I've read in my research, you see a lot of people struggling under this sort of parenting. There appears to be a lot of dishonesty because the pressure gets so high. So you end up fibbing to your parents, lying to them. Deception is, it appears to be a thing. And when you get into those territories, somebody called Jennifer's story the sort of perfect storm. You know, she refused to tell her parents the entire truth. So over this entire story, there are multiple points where her father lost patience and confronted her. And she kept sort of letting out bits of truths, but never actually letting out the full truth, which was her whole life from grade 9 on was essentially a fantasy. In most cases that I read about and researched, there was a time where the child came forward and said exactly what they had been doing. In this story, that never happened. And so it's led to I guess some people, including me, wondering whether Jennifer was somehow trying to shield her parents from the shame of her life, coming to this sort of final conclusion, rather than them having to deal with losing face. She decided to murder them. It's a theory. It's a crazy theory. But, I mean, it is an idea, because I do believe that there was a part of her, or there was a time, that really loved her parents. And I know her parents loved her. I mean, I would go as far as to say I blame Jennifer more than her parents. But every time I do that, as I said earlier, I think, you know, she was raised in their household. They raised her. They sort of created her. So it raises a really interesting question. And it's a really tragic one. And Paul talked a bit about, like, the mental health side of it. We don't know. We don't know if she's a narcissist, sociopath. We don't know. She said she was depressed. She said she was cutting herself. Psychologists, psychiatrists I spoke to said she doesn't display the signs of a depressed person. But again, it's there's a lot of questions, and that's what makes the story so interesting, I think, because the questions remain, and you can fall on either side of the divide.
Yeah, when I think about sort of the implications of it being a cultural thing where, you know, these people are immigrants and they come from a completely strange place with different ways of thinking, and you put them in a place where it's very Western thinking, and it's very like the way you grew up, Jeremy. You weren't pressured to go about academics and school. It's such a different, it's a huge contrast, and it's really the perfect storm when you get all this together. And I'm wondering, Paul, what the community sort of felt at the time that this happened. It must have had a ripple effect in the community conversation. If you could share that.
Yeah, I can recall even myself when I first heard about it on the news, I was shocked, because this is not a normal thing that you would get from like an Asian or Vietnamese community. It's just like just unheard of. So it was a big shock to everybody. And I think later on would be followed by embarrassment, because we are aware that like one person can represent the group. And when something of this nature happens, you can feel the effects of other people, like kind of like, is this a Vietnamese thing? Like, what's wrong with that group of people, right? So we feel the effects immediately. Just going, circling back a little bit to the whole, you know, shame, feeling shame in your parents and being deceptive. I have seen that, you know, amongst people that I knew. You know, one person I knew, this girl, actually, she got kicked out of university for just like low grades. But instead of telling her parents, she pretended to go to school for a whole year until they let her back in. But she didn't go resorting to other things that what Jennifer may have done, right? So I can understand that. You know, just you want to hide because you don't want to disappoint your parents. They work so hard, and I think we see that. I think the children see that, and you see how they struggle to adapt into the new land, especially if you're a Vietnamese, like immigrant, boat people. And yeah, we don't want to shame. And also, parents always really compare their kids to the other kids. Like, that, you know, their kid is a doctor, their kid's this and that. And so it's just like mind-boggling, like the pressure you have to deal with. But yeah, when this thing happened, it was a big shock to the community. And it takes a while to recover from it. Because one bad story, you probably need to do like 50 good stories to just reshape perceptions of the community.
And Jeremy, you reached out to Paul, because I understand that it was a book first, like you were working on researching the book. Did you reach out to Paul during those early years of researching for the book?
I think part of the reason why I felt it was so important to reach out to Paul and get his input when the doc was made was that some of the struggles I had when I was writing the book. I spent a year trying to speak to people associated to her family members. And I really had no luck with anyone of the Asian persuasion. Like there was no one that was willing to talk to me. And I should say, this is part of the reason why I was so fascinated with the story, is because Asian communities are kind of fenced off a little bit. They're not in the sort of Western media a lot. They don't speak to media. They don't necessarily trust the media. And so I felt it was necessary for me to collaborate and work with someone who better understood the ethnic aspects of the story, because there's a lot of them. And Paul did a great job and still does. I learned from him all the time. And he can speak to a lot of the things that I just know via research.
You know, and I thought about when you reached out to him, how much pressure that might weigh on you, Paul, to say, I'm going to open this up to the Western media and let them in on sort of like the dirty world of where we live. And, you know, how much of that kind of played into your decision to come on board?
I think having those initial discussions with Jeremy, also with the director, Jenny Popowell, and just hearing, like, you know, what place are they coming from to tell this story? Are they trying to, like, you know, what are they trying to do? And from the vibe that I got, like, they wanted to tell it the true story as true as possible. They didn't come in with a slant or a bias or a certain angle. It's more like, we want to explore. We want to get all the information and the facts we can and then present it. So I was really on board with that. That really, you know, I vibed with me, and I thought they're doing it for, you know, the right way. So, I was glad to participate and collaborate with them, and also learned a lot from Jeremy as well along the process. But I think it's also important for the Vietnamese community, now that we have this opportunity on a bigger platform, to actually, like, let's shed some light on this story. You know, let's not let someone else have the whole control of, like, this story. Like, let's, the people who are involved, we have an opportunity to say how it is.
Once something like this is done, what have you learned, both of you, in terms of the stories that you picked up that didn't make it into the movie? Because I understand there could be a sequel to this, because you probably left a lot of stuff out. But what did you learn after you put this together and worked with the community?
You don't have unlimited time. It is like a, you know, predefined format, especially if it's trying to fit into like 82-minute episode. But yeah, a lot of things were cut out for time. And also for brevity, and also, like, for the audience, you know, so they can consume this information in a appropriate manner. I think, yeah, maybe if the things that are left untold, and if there's still public interest, and if the people involved still have something to say, I'm sure we can explore that through other various formats. No. You know, perhaps like the Vietnamese podcast with you, we can get some of those guys to join. That could be an idea.
Yeah, I would love that.
But I think it really captivated, global audience, and I think it hit its mark, and people are aware of the story and aware of the sides of the story, and to have a, you know, more in-depth picture of, like, you know, Vietnamese family, Vietnamese person, some of the pressures and things we go through, and I think it was quite revealing.
One thing I learned is it's a very private community and a very proud community, and I have a great respect for Vietnamese people and all Asian people, because their cultural background is very close to their heart, and it doesn't fade very easily. You know, I'm a big proponent of close-knit families, and again, strict parents. I'm a big proponent of, cultural diversity and culture playing a huge role in your life, and believing in faith and family and background and, you know, the people that laid all the groundwork. And I guess what I learned is that I learned a lot about Asian communities, Asian culture, Vietnamese, Chinese, and I also. You know, when I was researching it, I learned so many interesting things about how Asian or Eastern cultures differ from Western cultures and why. And that, I believe, is one of the most important parts of both the book and the doc is why they're doing these things. You know, why, for example, the parents push so hard for the children to be involved in a musical pursuit or a cultural pursuit like piano. Why they push them so hard to be part of a sporting pursuit like figure skating that Jennifer was involved in. And part of the reason is for self-confidence. You know, if you can become excellent, if you can excel at a piano or figure skating, that gives you self-confidence from the inside, where, you know, a lot of Western people will put their kids in team sports. And yeah, that fulfills other things, but it's not really you doing it. You know, a lot of the success may depend on a lot of the other people on the team. So it taught me a lot and I learned a lot. And I also wanted to add, speaking off what Paul said about Jenny Popplewell, I neglected to mention how integral she was bringing on Paul and making sure we had, you know, a lot of representation from the community. And we got feedback from Paul and the community on our work to make sure it fit into a modern lens. And I think she achieved that in many ways.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful to have, to know this, that, you know, a community member, community leader like Paul, his voice was, you know, felt very inclusive, and it didn't feel like people who were disconnected to the Vietnamese culture made a movie about the Vietnamese culture. It felt like somebody on the inside was in, you know, on the T ear. So I felt it. And I didn't really know to what degree Paul was involved, but now I'm beginning to see how integral, you know, all of it was put together. I do want to ask, how difficult was it to get the authorities on camera? Because it just seemed like they carried a lot of this storytelling, whether it was in the interviewing room or, you know, these talking heads. I mean, you had the major players of the case talking on camera.
I think because this story is not just a crime story, right? It goes much further. And it's one of those stories that, or I think it's in the public interest for people to find out about, so we can learn from it. And so they were on board with the doc, and the doc's team, you know, focused on getting them involved, and they did a great job of doing that. And I don't know if you have anything to add, Paul.
Yeah, and yeah, for Paul, I mean, I'm sure there's probably a lot more community people that you guys were talking to, but you only showed a few people. Were there more people, or was it very difficult to get people on camera?
Because we're confined to like an 82-minute piece, we actually interviewed a lot of people. I think maybe 20.
Oh,
20, if I'm right, Jeremy. And it got cut down to 5 or 6. But even the testimony, specifically with Nam and Go Hung, the lady that knew the family, they spoke at length. I remember Go Hung's interviews probably 2 hours, 3 hours long when I was there on the set. But it ultimately got trimmed down to like a brief segment, but there was a lot of extended story and insight that had to be left in the editing room floor.
It was also nice to have someone speaking the ethnic language in the doc, and for it to be translated. It definitely gave that feel that, you know, it wasn't just a bunch of Western people speaking about a crime that happened. We got voices from inside the community.
And Paul, did you get a lot of, sort of after the film, did you get a lot of people talking about, you know, what kind of conversations were sparked from this film?
With the Vietnamese people specifically, I think they're aware of it. I mean, it was like covered in the media locally and all that kind of stuff. I think what I noticed the most was actually like the younger Vietnamese online, their reaction to it, to even little details. Like in the trailer, there's like a overhead shot of like the food scene, and it's like all Vietnamese food that my mom was there preparing on the set that day. But yeah, there was forums of conversations talking about it and discussing it. And I even showed my mom, like, hey, they talked about that one shot, like literally a few seconds that you prepared the various dishes, like winter melon, or I forgot what it was, titka, you know, that kind of stuff, right? people notice those things. And I think those little details matter, because if it was like ham and egg sandwiches, people were like, yeah, maybe it's not that offensive. But there were many scenes that were cut out, and there was a scene, you know, even flashback scenes, and they're sharing like Jemba now and stuff. So even though a lot of those details didn't get used, I'm glad that, you know, they put the effort to try to include them as much as possible, just to lend that authenticity. If we're doing a flashback scene and showing how this Vietnamese family operated, those are elements that are important.
Like you said in the beginning, Paul, where one person does something wrong, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe that person is Vietnamese, you know? That's just a real big thing, you know, like, oh God, it's a win or it's a trend, right? But when you accepted to come on, and, you know, there must have been something about like exposing this sort of world, you know, like, how do you know to trust the filmmakers to come in and do the right thing? You know, now I'm listening to this and I'm going, you know, it could go many different ways, but how do you know that this team is going to do the right thing?
Yeah, even when I spoke to the director, Jenny Popwell, initially, you know, a couple of years back, and she worked on another big documentary called American Murder, I think The Neighbor Next Door, I think that was called. And she told me how she received full cooperation from the victim's family, and how they were very pleased with the process, you know, of telling the story. And when they vouched for her, that was really, really strong point for me. So just to hear about the past experiences and to see her track record really played a big role in my decision to join them.
When Jenny first reached out to me, I watched her first documentary. I also spoke to her quite thoroughly. And, you know, I'm a kind of a loyal guy. I'm very trusting. And I base most of my decisions in terms of who I want to work with just out of a conversation. And she was super cool. Like she was just like a totally normal person that you'd meet. And we had conversations, you know, where we became sort of fast friends. And right then I knew that she's going to do a good job.
The last name Pan is not typically Vietnamese. In fact, it threw me off. It still throws me off. And I'm wondering, is that something, you know, it sounds like a small detail, but it's not. Because many times there's this ethnic divide within the Vietnamese world. There's 53 ethnic tribes. There's, you know, that are not considered Vietnamese culture. They're in Vietnam. And I wasn't sure if, Paul, you know of the family name. Pan is not, I've never really heard that name.
As far as I was aware, I think they're ethnically Chinese from Vietnam and then made their way over to Canada. I mean, when I was going around researching and also making contacts, searching for people that knew the Pan family, a lot of Vietnamese people are like, Pan is not a Vietnamese last name. Like even Vietnamese people were kind of surprised about that. But yeah, as far as I know, like they're ethnically Chinese. And I know, because we all know Nguyen. It's like the predominant last name, like 90% of us. But yeah, that's as far as I know.
The mom has more recent ties to China through Hong Kong. I believe the family is ethnically Chinese. I'm not sure how long the father had been in Vietnam, or the mother, prior to them coming to Canada. And that's, you know, part of the reason of that is that I couldn't access family members. And so, you know, a lot of what we have is from the court records, from, you know, piano teachers, friends and family, friends, not family, that have been around her. So we just sort of got bits and pieces, but it was a very long court case. It was almost a year. It's the longest in Canadian history. So we did get a lot of information.
This question is for both of you. You are probably both very aware of what was left on the cutting room floor in the edit. Is there anything that you can share, that one or two things that you felt like that was left out that
should make it in the film that you could share with us?
Good question. Jeremy, do you want to go or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot left out. We focused, the film was focused on the interrogation and everything that came as a result of that. There's so much. I mean, you know, one thing that's interesting in the book is how when she was a child, she was very focused on getting perfect on her school assignments. And when she didn't get perfect, she would go up to the teacher and say, "Why didn't I get perfect?" And the teacher did feel that some of the pressure was coming from her family. She used to work on homework until midnight. She'd wake up really early in the morning to go figure skating. She was she wanted to go to the Olympics figure skating. She was an amazing piano player. When she went into grade 9, she met a boy, and you know, it all sort of the world that she had built up for herself through her family kind of fell apart, and that's when the lies began. And you know, I would say she became a fantasist because she lied from grade 9 on. She became very good at it, and it would ultimately be her demise.
There's a lot of tidbits I don't know if I can say, but there is a lot of, even just after with the court case, there people were commenting, where there's testimony about like how she is treated. She's currently, you know, obviously in jail, right? And even in the past, like when I was doing my research and I contacted some people, and even I contacted a lady who was actually my Vietnamese language teacher when I was 10 years old, which is like 30 something years ago. And she knew Jennifer, and she saw her out and about, and she knew her family, and saw her as a little kid, young kid, you know, just playing and being a normal kid. So a lot of things like that, obviously these people are not on camera, so those things don't get captured. But I heard, you know, a lot of stories from various people, family members and friends. So all that stuff was not in the doc.
Jeremy, this question goes to you as a father. And you've mentioned how strict you are a few times. And I've paid attention to that language coming from you. You emphasize it. And I wonder how you feel knowing this story so intimately, where the border, where the line is between pressure, strictness, or being more loose with your child. Like, where, how do we find the balance in raising our children?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I can only speak through my research. I mean, sorry, I can speak as a father. But I would guess it, most of it sort of rang true in terms of research. So there is something called tiger parenting. I believe in Asia it's called dragon parenting. There's a book on it. And that's when it became popular. The idea that became popular in the West, where it's very strict and controlling. So there's few friends, no parties, no sleepovers. You focus on family. You focus on schooling. When you have get together or play dates, it's with family. And your time is very constricted and controlled. So when you have free time, it's to do these pursuits, not to fool around, hang out, relax on. Then there's the many people think the Western way of parenting, which is very, very relaxed. A child can misbehave and not necessarily be punished. Not necessarily have strict controls around their free time, not necessarily have chores around the house, not necessarily be screamed at or yelled at or punished. And that is, a lot of Western parenting these days surrounds that, and some people disagree with it. And I can't remember what the official name is. It's something like loose parenting. And then there's something in between, and I read a lot about this. It's called panda parenting, where you're very loving and comforting and emotionally aware and available. But when the child misbehaves, you can lash out. And you can that's when you can become the fierce panda. So there's a loving panda and there's a fierce panda. And this is sort of viewed as maybe the way forward, where there's a bit of both. You know, it's a nice balance between the strict, demanding, controlling parenting and the loose, very forgiving parenting that that is often under attack in modern era. Somewhere in between, because kids do benefit from, you know, boundaries, and, you know, kids try and push the envelope and they need to know where is the red line. And I think kids benefit from doing chores. And I often get in trouble for my own kids for making them do the dishes, take out the garbage, rake the leaves, so on. But I think it teaches them important things. You know, kids, I believe, look up to their parents and take their examples from them. And they need to be put in their place when they misbehave. So I almost feel like I'm going to get in trouble for saying that, because it's society these days, you know, they're very risk averse when it comes to children, because, you know, there can be negative effects to being a strict parent. And this story is a perfect example. But I believe there is a balance. You know, I trust parents to reach it.
I'm not pushing for any type of narrative answer from both, but I am curious if you both have an opinion if Jenny was a good human being or not.
I think everyone, obviously, grew up good by nature. And those things can fall to the wayside, whether through by environment or the people you hang around with. And I think perhaps, you know, in when she was in a time of need and having that kind of pressure from her parents and all the activities she's doing, you know, not having the right outlet or the right support, you can go down a different road than you normally would have. And that's a lot. I deal with a lot of that, you know, growing up in a community where I am in Jane and Finch in Toronto. There's a lot of like negative forces, the street life. Gangs and that kind of stuff. You can have a perfectly normal kid. I played with these guys since we were like grade school. We play ball on the street. Some people become successful doctors, successful journalists. Some people doing 25 to life in jail. But we all start off, we all play Nintendo. We all like bought candy at the convenience store. But I think, yeah, parenting has an aspect of a role in that. You have to have good parenting to be well-rounded, but also the people and the friends you choose and hang around with and the activities you participate in also matters. I just want to go back about the parenting thing. I'm not a parent myself, not yet, but I can speak towards the Vietnamese style of parenting. And I think Kenneth, you'll be very familiar with this. The way sometimes the parents treat us, I know it's coming from a loving, you know, a source of love. It's coming from love. But, you know, when I would tell my friends how we grew up, they, and if they're Western, they would be like kind of shocked. They're like, oh, that's like, you know, mental abuse. Because, you know, if you be ang dang, you have to kwantai, you get beeped. So basically getting in trouble, hearing comments is kind of like normal. Like if you're bad, your parents would say, oh, I should have bop lo mo yi when you're a baby. That means pinch your nose when you're a baby.
Should have strangled you.
Those are casual comments that we get, Jeremy. So now I can look back and laugh at it. By the time when you're a kid, you're like, are they serious? So I think not just Vietnamese, but, you know, just those kind of tough parenting, but they mean well. And to instill a little fear in you so you don't, like, get too totally out of line. But those are just a, you know, funny side. I'm pretty sure Kenneth has heard many of those comments before when you were growing up.
It's the ultimate question. And I tried my best to stand on the fence the whole time. My opinion on the matter is, I'm still, yeah, this is the one of the most amazing parts about this story is that I still don't really know. There's a part of me that thinks that she's definitely evil and sick person. There's another part of me that you know, is a father and believes that she is very misguided. And yeah, as Paul said very eloquently, you know, there was times in her life where she needed someone and that person wasn't there. and therefore she kept on the path, the evil path. I think she's sick. Is how I'd answer it. So I don't really believe in evil, as hard as that may be to believe, because there's some evil seeming people out there. I think that they're just really sick. I think no human being is evil, but they're very troubled. And I think that's what she is. And I hope she finds peace one day.
You know, these type of cases get, every now and then, they get reopened up decades later. Case in point, we have the Menendez brothers right now in LA who killed both their mom and dad. These two brothers killed their mom and dad in Beverly Hills 20-something, 30 years ago. And now what we're finding out is there's an appeal is that the courts are opening up the case to see if it can be exonerated or opened up to leave prison because the circumstances surrounding why the motive, which was left out of court. Do you think as time goes on, as the decades go on, that we will learn more things about psychology, or the courts will be more tender towards, you know, abuse, and learn more about, you know, Asian culture and the way it's sort of put up against Western culture, and you know, there's a chance for her to kind of like people to kind of review her case and be like, okay, well, we understand what happened. Maybe we give her another shot at life. Is there, you know, I actually want to end on that question because that's something that left me when I finished the documentary going, I wonder in 30 years, is it going to be like the Menendez brothers? She's finally up for something like a parole situation. Is that a possibility that there are more details that'll come out that we understand the circumstances are not what we understood it to be when what Jennifer did was made?
So Jeremy, I think you can speak about the during the mid-production about the latest update, the legal case.
There was an appeal. The case was overturned, or the first degree murder conviction was overturned. It's now going to the Supreme Court. But that's on a technicality. I would say no in this case, because she herself said that there was never any sexual abuse. There was no physical abuse. I guess some people could consider some of this mental abuse or emotional abuse, but that's so complicated, right? Because how many times did this sort of parenting lead to successful, well-adjusted people that are excellent community members? Very, very often. And from what I can tell, Asian community in Canada are some of the lowest crime offenders, some of the best citizens we have in terms of contributing and not taking away from our society. It's a difficult one, but I wouldn't say that there's ever going to be a review of this case that shines well on Jennifer.
Obviously, as knowledge expands, especially with these like psychology and those kind of like social sciences, as long as I think people are able to present like a full picture, both sides, and then the courts can decide, you know, having all the information, a full breadth of information to consider into their decision. With this, I don't know. Jeremy said before, I hope Jennifer can find peace, however it ends up. I think that's the most important. And obviously, you know, for the family members, victims and friends and everyone related, that everyone has that peace inside. That's the most important.
I want to thank both of you so much for coming on. I know it was kind of, you know, it took a long time for Paul and Jeremy, for you both to come onto the podcast. I really appreciate you both spending such quality time with me. Is there anything that you, any parting words for the audience?
I encourage anyone that is interested by the doc to read the book or by the story, because there's a lot more information out there, and it's a lot more complex than it appears. And it may paint Jennifer in a very different light than what you think currently. So I guess I would say go buy the book or listen to the audiobook.
My parting shot would be for other fellow Vietnamese and also non-Vietnamese. Love your parents. Love yourself. Work on that communication. Have that open dialogue. It's something I'm actually, you know, still working on today with my own parents. And I always encourage other people, you know, if they're going through issues, don't keep it inside. Don't keep it locked up inside. Just find someone you trust and share it and, you know, get that support so you don't have to take go down a bad road. And yeah, we got to live together and appreciate each other. And let's have that, keep that dialogue going.
Paul and Jeremy, thank you so much both for coming on.
Thanks, Kenneth.
Nice meeting you, Kenneth. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.